Welcome to Parents Perspective. I just can't calm him down, Jane sighed, twisting her napkin into a spiral as she sat with her friend Betsy. Betty just seems to get up in the mornings wired and can't wind down until he finally collapses in his bed at night. I don't know what I'm going to do.
Aren't six-year-olds, and boys especially, supposed to be like that? Betsy inquired.
Not like this, Jane replied. He's just wild. He knocks over things, he plays rough with a dog, he even teases Samantha. And she's so little she doesn't even know how to respond.
What are they saying at school? Betsy wondered aloud.
It's amazing. At school he does have some wild periods, but mostly he's just quiet.
Even too quiet, Jane responded.
It's almost like his head is somewhere else. I just don't know what to do.
You know, Betsy prodded gently, it's not as though things are exactly normal at home. First, Bill was in the hospital. Now he's having chemo with all its troubles. I think Benny is just acting out his worries about his dad.
From a parent's perspective, how can we help children cope when their parent is seriously ill? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest has worked to educate, comfort, and inspire families coping with just these kinds of issues, including her own. Dr. Wendy Harpam is a doctor of internal medicine, best-selling author, long-term cancer survivor, and mother of three. As a practitioner, author, lecturer, and patient advocate, she has worked to help others through the synergy of science and caring. Her books include Diagnosis Cancer, Your Guide to the First Months of Healthy Survivorship, After Cancer, Happiness in a Storm, and When a Parent Has Cancer, which is accompanied by the award-winning children's book, Becky and the Worry Cup. Dr. Harpam also writes a regular column, View from the Other Side of the Stethoscope, for the professional magazine Oncology Times, addressing common challenges to the care of the cancer patient from her vantage as a physician survivor. She lives in Texas with her husband and three children, one of whom just graduated from college, one is in college, and one has just graduated from high school. Welcome to Parents Perspective, Dr. Harpam.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Harpam, we'd like to have you begin by telling your own personal story for our listeners.
In 1990, I was a very busy practitioner in a solo practice of internal medicine. My children were 1, 3, and 5 years old, and I developed non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which is a cancer of the lymph system. I had to close my practice, I underwent chemotherapy, and the cancer went into remission. But over the next 17 years, my cancer kept recurring, and I needed repeated courses of treatment. I mentioned that my children were 1, 3, and 5, and over the course of those years, I didn't get well, and I didn't die. And I was forced to learn about raising healthy children when a parent is seriously ill. The long course of my illness was very challenging and stressful, but I had the luxury of time to learn what worked and what didn't, and to share my experiences and my insights with other parents who are trying to raise their children when a parent is seriously ill.
What's the most important thing to remember when you're dealing with a child who has a seriously ill parent? If you had to take a nugget, what would you tell parents?
The first thing is that you can't escape the fact that illness is in the family. Accepting that a parent is seriously ill and then choosing to use the unwanted experience to raise your children in healthy ways frees you to embrace the life you have. I used my unwanted illness, the unwanted stresses and changes and losses, to teach my children the skills and values that I would want to teach them if I'd never been sick.
In one of your books, you talk about the elephant in the room and parents wanting to throw a blanket over the elephant and just spend a lot of time pretending it's not there.
Well, part of that is that the parents' instincts drive them to try to shield their children from the terrible crisis. A key helpful insight is that you can't shield them. Children are very observant. They will notice, even if there are no physical changes, they will notice an increased stress. They will see these whispered telephone calls or that mommy or daddy was crying or not acting like their usual selves because the parents are dealing with their own crisis. If you don't include the children in the family illness, you are leaving them to use their own devices to understand what's happening and find ways to cope. And the danger is that they will develop an inaccurate or unhopeful interpretation of what's happening and find maladaptive ways of coping. Conversely, including them in the crisis gives you the power as a parent to guide your children toward healthy and hopeful interpretations of what's happening and healthy, hopeful, and even joyful ways of living their life with illness.
What's interesting is I was thinking as you were talking about this, what a stress this is and what a challenge this is and so on and so forth. But I guess we have to remember as grown-ups that whatever deficits we have, we've lived life a whole lot longer than our kids, and they have many fewer ways of coping than we have in our arsenals.
And the crux of the problem in a family when a parent is seriously ill or chronically ill is how can the parent be a good parent when their own needs are so great?
How would our responses differ for a child or teen who has lost a parent?
First, I'll address the key similarity. And the underlying principle is that our job as parents is to help our children develop and grow into mature, responsible, happy adults. So that responsibility is the same. When a child has lost a parent, the key job is helping the child grieve, adjust to the loss, and then embrace the memory of the lost parent in life-enhancing, joyful ways. That's very different than the situation where a child's parent is seriously ill, because in that case, the challenge is helping the child find a balance of acceptance, accepting the illness, the uncertainty, the losses, at the same time hoping for improvement for the parent, at the same time hoping to embrace the life they do have, maximizing whatever time you have with the parent. And if the parent is terminally ill and expected to die, the responsibility is to prepare their child for the coming loss so that they know that they'll be able to adjust and embrace life after the loss. I dealt with this because in 1993, my prognosis was not good. And I felt one of my responsibilities as a parent was to prepare my children for the possibility that I would die before they grew up. And my key message to my children was, I don't want to die. I don't want to leave you. We are doing everything we can to make it so that I can be here for you. But if I die, you will feel my love every day for the rest of your life. If I die, after you get through the sadness about losing me, you will remember me in joyful ways. You will love your life, even if without me.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on helping children cope with the serious illness of a parent.
The popular new book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents, by Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. We are talking with Dr. Wendy Harpam about helping children cope with the serious illness of a parent. How do children's responses to these kinds of enormously destabilizing situations correlate with their stages of development? There must be different kinds of responses, just like in the beginning story, for different stages of development.
How a child deals with their life depends on their intellectual development, their emotional development, as well as their personal experiences. If you have a child who, when they were 7, lost their grandparent, that child's reaction to a parent's illness is going to be very different than an equally intelligent and emotionally mature 7-year-old who has never experienced death at all. The key is to listen to where your children are. Parents know their children. Mm-hmm. Parents know where their children are intellectually, what they can understand, and their emotional temperament. Listen to your children. They will clue you into what they need to know, what they want to know, what they can handle, and what they can't.
This is like the child asking where do babies come from.
Right.
getting a very lame response.
And the little mantra I use is, tell your children enough. You don't have to tell them everything. When I went through my first round of chemotherapy, and after a very grueling 7 months, my cancer was pronounced in remission, and my 4-year-old daughter, Jessie, asked the million-dollar question. Mom, now that your cancer's gone, can it come back? An honest answer would have been yes. Clearly, that answer would not have helped her deal with her concern. On the other hand, giving a very long, complicated answer would not have helped her either. So I addressed her immediate concern. Yes, my cancer could come back, but the doctors think, with the treatment I've had, that it won't. Or if it does, it won't be till you're all grown up. But, Jesse, if my cancer comes back, we can treat it again. We got through it before. We can get through it again. I linked the truth of the matter with support and hope that we could deal with what happened. And if you said to me, Wendy, I'm only going to give you 1 minute to teach parents what they need to know, it would be this. Establish and maintain open lines of communication. And always tell the truth, couched in love and support. As I travel around the country, I have been humbled by the wide variety of approaches that parents take and successfully raise their children through a parent's illness. But the one underlying principle that I think is necessary is to always tell the truth, because the children need to be able to trust you to deal with what is happening. My oldest daughter was 5 when I was first diagnosed. She is now 22. I guarantee you that if you asked her, what was the one main thing that helped you? She'll tell you it was that mommy always told me the truth. I never had to waste energy worrying or wondering what was happening. And again, it's linked with this idea that we can deal with the truth. As young adults now, it is amazing to watch my children because they are resilient. They know that sometimes you can do the right thing and things won't go well and you move forward. They know about hope, that you create hopes, and if your hopes are dashed, you create new hopes. This idea that by always telling the truth through the ups and downs of my illness, we have a solid bond of trust, and they know they can deal with whatever happens.
There's so many families where they haven't gone through any kind of crisis where trust doesn't exist. So the trust and the communication are so key.
And the trust and the communication go both ways. Mm-hmm. My children know they can trust me. I know I can trust them. And one of my favorite greeting cards when I was going through my illness was this. The cover said, "It's you and me against the world," and you open it up. Do you think they have a chance?
Wonderful. What kinds of day-to-day strategies might be helpful for children during a parent's chronic illness?
In the opening, I mentioned that the key task of children is growing up into responsible, happy adults. So focusing on the day-to-day strategies that help your children continue in that trajectory of developing, maturing, growing will help. One thing is routines. Routines are very reassuring for children that no matter what's happening with mom or dad, they're going to have breakfast, they're going to have lunch, they're going to have dinner, they have to brush their teeth, they have to go to bed at a certain time, they have to get their homework done. Helping children continue their regular routine, reassuring, and it creates boundaries. And a key point when a parent is seriously ill is you may need help to maintain that ritual. There were many times when I was physically too sick or I was in the hospital and I couldn't do the routines. But I had friends, I had relatives come in and help the routines get done, even if I wasn't the actor. The other thing is rituals help a child feel like life is normal, life is going on, even in the setting of serious illness. Every Sunday for lunch, my family has bagels, and we end dessert with a black and white cookie cut into as many pieces as we need. And that fun, dependable ritual helped things feel stable, even when medically things were up and down or not going well. I think having a calendar can help children as a day-to-day strategy. A calendar of what's happening with the mom or dad. We let the children know on Mondays mommy's having her chemo, in which case they knew they could prepare for mommy being more tired and less available on Tuesday and Wednesday. And a calendar for the children. This sends a message, your schedule, your needs, your activities are important. One other thing that we did in my home was we had special mommy and me time. The point being, it's very easy for the family to get consumed with the illness, that all you ever focus on, all you ever talk about is how mommy or daddy is feeling, what treatments are going on, when the checkups are. Parents help their children when they consciously choose to have happy time in there. It doesn't have to be a big, extravagant thing. It can be 5 minutes of quiet reading time that's inviolable, that you don't answer the phone, you don't answer the doorbell. This is mommy me time. In my home, we had private night-night time. I had 3 children, but their night-night time was not done together. I had time with baby William. I had time with Jesse. I had time with Becky. And it became an opportunity to share some fun, for me to test out, does this child have any concerns or questions that need to be addressed? And for me to reinforce, no matter what's happening with me physically, one thing stays the same. I love you with all my heart.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on helping children cope with the serious illness of a parent.
For an audio CD of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $15 with your name, mailing address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C. 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Dr. Wendy Harpam about helping children cope with the serious illness of a parent.
I loved reading about the songs that you sang each night. Each child had a song that was especially for that child. First of all, they knew that even when you were practicing medicine and might not be able to be home, that Daddy would call on the phone and you would sing the song on the phone. And it carried over to when you had to be in a hospital and couldn't be home with them. Daddy could make that same phone call and you could sing that song yourself. I thought that was very touching and also very reassuring for children.
I actually made a little 10-minute tape with a home tape recorder for my son that went through our usual routine that could be played on the days that I was too sick to do it myself.
I remember you said in one of your books that there are good times to talk to kids, and it's based primarily on their ages or stages of development. Do you want to share that?
Younger children can have a difficult time switching from conversation to relaxing and letting go and going to sleep. So in general, I discourage parents from using right before they go to sleep to share difficult news or that there's going to be some change that's going to affect the child. Older children, teenagers, have an easier time, and because of their busy schedules, you may get their attention and be able to connect with them better in the evening right before bed. But again, I make the point, right before you say goodnight and leave the door and turn out the light, switch to something positive, either some fun activities that are coming up that week, what's on the child's mind, something you can celebrate. So that last thought before they begin to let go is positive. Another tool that we did in my home was to make a habit of, before we went to sleep, naming five things or three things that happened that day that were fun or special or happy. They could be just despite the fact that there's illness in the house, and sometimes because of illness in the house. And you say, how could something be good because of illness? Well, the illness is bad, and I make that clear. It's not a gift. It's not wonderful. The illness is bad, but sometimes good things happen in the setting of illness and even because of illness. For example, I was a busy doctor. I really didn't spend time sitting in bed and watching TV with my kids. But during the hard days after chemotherapy, one of the ways I could be with my kids that wasn't taxing for me was to watch a show together. And so one of the things my child would say at night was, boy, you never watched TV with us before, and now you watched a whole show with us. Something good from something bad. And when I watch my children now as young adults, when they're in situations that are unpleasant, they will make the effort automatically to say, well, we didn't want this to happen this way, but maybe something good will come out of it. Or look at this good thing that came out of something that wasn't the way we planned or wanted.
You're giving them an arsenal, basically, of things to use.
It's a healthy, joyful way of dealing with the life they have.
What are some signs of serious trouble in an affected child's mental health?
I go back to this idea that the child's primary task is developing, maturing, growing into a healthy, joyful adult. When you see blockages in that ongoing development, when you see regression slipping back, not short-term, but long-term, that's a red flag that this child is having trouble. A child who was potty-trained and now is not, and it's not just for one or two accidents, but they are consistently not trained anymore, a child who used to sleep well at night and who's now getting up a number of times or calling for you in the middle of the night, a child who used to be very talkative and is now very withdrawn, performing in school, wanting to be with their friends. These are key behaviors that clue a parent in that something's wrong, the child is under distress, and it's the child's cry for help.
The other thing, I guess, there's an underlying assumption that parents keep in touch with a child's teachers and or counselors so that people at school know what's going on at home.
Exactly. This is a shared mission. And I made a conference with each of my children's teachers to clue them in not only to what was happening at home, but my approach to dealing with the children. Honest, open, sharing. And this brings up the idea that I needed the children's time out of the home to be very much focused on non-cancer, not on my illness. I asked the teachers never to ask, and I asked my children's friends' parents never to ask in front of the kid, how's your mom? How's your mom doing? Is she in treatment? Let the kid escape the illness and focus on their task, which is learning at school, being with their friends, doing their extracurricular activities, and growing up. And I promised to keep them informed. On the other hand, if a child brought up the topic, I encourage them to please welcome this, welcome their questions. This way, we can all be tuned into how is the child doing. Child may feel safe asking a kindergarten teacher or a coach about their mom when maybe they feel they couldn't ask me directly because they wouldn't want to upset me. So if we work as a team, as the adults work as a team to help the children, then we have that many more ears and minds to pick up clues if the child has a question or a problem, and to respond to the child in a healthy way.
It appears that in your case, the children accepted that it was okay to ask you things. They don't seem to have been worried about upsetting you by asking you how you were doing or what was going on. Is that the case?
That is the case. And sometimes, I remember once my son had a little rash, and he came to me and he said, well, could this be cancer? And though it's sad that it would even cross his mind that prickly heat would be cancer, it was really good that he did tell me what was on his mind, and he wasn't afraid to ask because I could reassure him completely, and him knowing I'm going to tell the truth, he could take it. Mm-hmm. I said, no, this is absolutely not cancer, and done. He just didn't worry about it, and he moved on, as opposed to wondering and worrying, and it's weighing on you, and then the parent doesn't know why the child's irritable, and it's because he has a fear that's totally irrational, but he's afraid to share the fear.
How can we assess whether a mental health intervention for a child or adolescent will be successful?
If you see the child getting back on track, getting back with friends, being their usual personality, becoming involved in their world, you can feel pretty reassured that this child is doing okay. If you continue to see behaviors that are out of their personality, if you continue to see them having trouble in school, trouble with their friends, trouble eating or sleeping, just incredible difficulty fitting in at home, then you may have a more serious problem. It's better to err on the side of getting professional help and having the professional say, no, no, this is all age appropriate, your child is doing just fine, than trying to avoid or delay getting help.
Is there something that you want to leave our audience with after all this experience that you've had dealing with the ups and downs of cancer and raising the children? Is there anything special you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Life is good, even when it's not what you expect or want or hope for or plan for. Life is good, even when it's hard. I encourage parents to use the unwanted illness to teach their children the skills and values they'd want to teach them if they'd never been sick. When my children had to work around my limits, they learned to be flexible. When my children learned to tend to my needs, they learned to be compassionate. When my children saw me as whole, even when I had bandages or I was limping or I couldn't do things, they learned self-love. When they had to fend for themselves, they learned self-sufficiency. And when they dealt with my setbacks, they learned about perseverance and resilience. The greatest gift we can give our children is not protection from the world, but the confidence and the tools to cope and grow with all that life has to offer.
We need to go to resources, Dr. Harpham, and ask you, what would you suggest for our listeners who might want to further pursue some of the issues we've been addressing with you?
Two books that I found very helpful. One is How to Help Children Through a Parent's Serious Illness by Kathleen McHugh. And as you mentioned, I wrote the book set, When a Parent Has Cancer, A Guide to Caring for Your Children. And though the book takes place in the context of cancer survivorship, almost every single message in there is for helping children deal with a parent's illness, whatever it is. That book does come with a children's book, Becky and the Worry Cup, which is geared at a third grade reading level, but is very useful for much older children and can be read to younger children. I also have a beautifully illustrated book written by Laura Numeroff and myself called The Hope Tree that will be available starting in 2008 through Komen. I encourage parents to connect with the child's pediatrician. Hospital social worker may be able to connect you with local resources, support groups for children, support groups for parents. Going to the disease-specific organization, they may be able to direct you for resources for the parents and the children that are geared to the specific disease with which you're dealing. For instance, in cancer, we have the American Cancer Society has groups for children, Gilda's Club, Wellness Community, that sort of thing. Nowadays, there are virtual support communities on the internet. And again, looking, searching for your disease-specific support, you may find yourself with wonderful resources for helping your children. One particular resource is called Kids Connected with two Ks, and it's written by children for children, a wonderful site.
Well, you have been just a wonderful fount of resources and information and inspiration for all of us. So, Dr. Wendy Harpham, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Our gift for our first caller is a copy of Dr. Harpham's book, When a Parent Has Cancer, A Guide to Caring for Your Children. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. And please spell anything that's not obvious. That's a big help to us. Mention show number 342 and tell us, if you can, what station you're listening to.
Visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org, where you can even listen to a show of your choice. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. We're grateful for generous support from the American Psychiatric Foundation in the production of this program, and we need your responses. We offer a special gift to all respondents. Please go to the website, www.parentsperspective.org, and reply to the very brief questionnaire you will find at the listing for show number 342. Thank you for caring. Our sound engineer is Drew Chapp. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.